Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
One of the concerns that we've brushed up against, for instance, is, oh, well, like if your kid doesn't learn a foreign language when they're young, that will be harder when they're grown-ups, mm-hmm. you know, when their minds are more firmed up. Well, what if they don't learn to be self-directed when they're young? What happens when they're grown-ups? Is that all also like a hardened neurological pathway that they can't get back? Who knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I would hope to shoot for, is like kids that practice the hard work of being self-directed and making decisions now, so that when they're our age, they're like, yeah, I've been doing this forever. Like, what do you mean you can't figure out what you want to do? Like, I know how to do that now.
And maybe then they also, I mean, I don't want to be naive. I'm sure that they're going to struggle with things, but maybe then they also don't have all of the baggage that comes with breaking away from kind of falling in line and doing what's expected of you, right? Like, we've come to, all of us, I think, have come to kind of a self-directed way of living, but at least for me, it did come with some baggage of like, am I going to disappoint people by doing this thing that's really different? And what does it actually mean to be true to myself and to how I want to spend my time? And hopefully, because this is just a natural way of living for our kids, maybe they won't have to kind of overcome that additional hurdle.
Used to ride the highway. I used to know where I was going. Now this shady dirt road is feeling cool beneath my feet. Used to ride on to get to where I was going in a day. Now I've got to stop, go and stop, go along.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is June 6th. When I was in New Hampshire last weekend, I was fortunate enough to be invited to the home of a wonderful family, the Davises. You might remember James Davis. He was on the show last fall. We did a show called Forced Learning is Too Dangerous. Wow, that's a provocative title. If you haven't heard that show, you should probably go check it out. We recorded that at the Free Coast Fest. And this time, I joined James and his wife Taylor in their home. I got to meet their three amazing young boys. You're going to hear about that in our conversation today. But they recently started a website and a podcast called One Free Family, where they explore what they call a new take on peaceful parenting from a variety of angles. And they talk a lot about how education works in their home as well. Now, what's interesting is less than 15 years ago, both James and Taylor were on track to become public school teachers. So our conversation begins with my question: what happened? It sent you in another direction. Because you don't hear that story too much. I mean, I've told that story. It happened to me around the same time that it happened to them, which is very cool. Not a lot of people have that story. And we'll talk about several themes that have come up on their podcast in the last few months, including how they own their unusual parenting choices, their differing attitudes about structure, you know, because you're going to need some structure. And we'll also talk about these screens, right? Whether they're televisions or computers or video games or mobile devices, and what role they play. But I was pretty interested to hear their take on what is a subject of a considerable debate in the self-directed education, homeschooling, unschooling community over young people and their screen time. And if you're interested in exploring that further, I have great news. The pilot episode of the new School Sucks bonus show, The Mastermind, is out. And Jason Osborne, Gardner Goldsmith, and I, we're the podcast masters, in case you don't know about that. Google that and find out more. But the three of us have a conversation that's related to that topic as well. It's a bit of a darker approach. But if you're interested in hearing more discussion about that, please check out the pilot episode of The Mastermind. You can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks or schoolsucksproject.com/AV to get access to The Mastermind. It's going to be a weekly series. Season 1, Episode 1 is already in the can. It's with Richard Grove and Kevin Cole. It should be out this weekend, and I'm excited about this. And one more thing about the conversation with Taylor and James. At the end, because they have this experience training to be teachers, doing student teaching. They both worked with kids in summer camps with very different attitudes about how adults and children best interact back in the day. And I certainly had that experience as well as a teacher. So we talk about how we've kind of processed some of the mistakes and maybe even some of the regrets that we've had in our past experience working with young people. It's all on the show today. I'm glad to be back. I'm sorry about the long stretch without a show, but this one makes it worth the wait. And that sounds like something a guy would just say, you know, to pacify an angry audience. But we're friends. I'm not worried about you guys being angry. You understand, and you've got other things to do. But I'm really happy with this conversation, and I definitely look forward to talking to Taylor and James again. And if you want more of their work and their insights, please go to onefreefamily.com. All right, everybody, let's get to it. Thanks for listening, and take care. So welcome, James and Taylor Davis, to School Sucks.
Yay, we're excited here. To be here.
Well, James, welcome back, and Taylor, welcome for the first time.
Thank you.
So you guys started a podcast earlier this year and a website that goes with it called One Free Family. I think, James, when you were on the show, it was September last year.
Right.
You were just getting this project going.
Well, I think I famously had nothing to promote on the podcast. You asked me, do I have anything, any place people can find me? And I said, absolutely not, because I was just so excited to be on the show. And then I think a couple months later, our friend Roger from Pax Libertas Productions came and said, because he had actually seen us speak at the Free Coast Fest, the same one you were at, and said, hey, we got to get you guys. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. See me. You didn't speak at all there because you were back here. But he saw me speak and said, hey, we should get you on a podcast. And he agreed to have his team do all the stuff that I don't like to do, like edit and produce. And we could just talk about parenting, which we like to do anyway. So it seemed like a good fit.
Well, that's awesome. So you've got about, what, 16, 17 episodes?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and I've listened to almost a handful of them. And I think they're great. One of the things that I really like about it is you guys seem very flexible in your approach to talking about a lot of these subjects. It's not like we know everything or we're gurus. You know, you talked about all of the things that we're saying on this show. We didn't believe these things so many years ago, and maybe that's you now. And you also, in one of the earlier shows, you talked about a kind of gradient between structure, which you guys had different attitudes about structure. Like, I think, Taylor, you said you like structure.
Oh, yeah, for my own life, sure.
Yeah, and you're more unstructured. And then I bet for each one of your three kids, there's some variance as well for how they do with structure. And the freedom that people often associate with unschooling. So you're always trying to find that gradient. And I'm sure it differs from child to child.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the things that we've really arrived to recently is understanding, because I think in our minds, and we actually just talked about this on our episode that's coming up soon, but in our minds, I think in our culture, we kind of worship consistency as this idea that, like, once you find an idea, you have to stick with it forever. If you're a politician, you're a flip-flopper. If you don't stick with the same idea, if your kid asks you a question and you say no, you should stick with that no until your kid is 45, and then you can come clean and tell them the truth about what you really feel or something. But we're actually moving away from that. We're hoping to become less consistent and more intentional. And I think that creates a lot of space for owning the fact that we used to think things that now we think are demonstrably false, that we used to do things that we would never do today as parents. And that actually just gives so much freedom and makes parenting about the process, not about being right all the time.
And I think that's really welcoming for new people who are exploring these ideas. It's kind of unfortunate that some of the terms we use have this implicit judgment built into them, like peaceful parenting. And that's one of the words you guys use for the show. So, like, what's the alternative to peaceful parenting?
Yeah, violent parenting.
It's interesting that you brought that up, because when we were thinking about – it took us a while to figure out what are we going to call this podcast. And we were really trying to push away the term peaceful parenting. James has said to me a lot in the past, like, I really don't love that term. Ultimately, we landed on it as, like, the subtitle, because – mostly we felt like it would make it easier for people to find our show. You know, people
who
are hoping to find more peaceful ways of parenting their kids, you know, they would be searching for peaceful parenting, and so they would find us. But I totally agree.
Yeah, we're just riding SEO coattails, basically.
Oh, yeah, these are people who know SEO going into a podcast. I'm very envious.
Peaceful parenting, I think all the terms, you know, anytime people are coming up with terms for things, like unschooling is another term I'm not a huge fan of because it positions itself as being against school.
Right.
I don't really care about school very much. I just want people to be self-directed. And sometimes that's going to mean attending a school.
Like
if you want to be a doctor, you're going to unschool your body into a school to learn the things you need to be to become a doctor. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just that sometimes when you walk into a space, there are just terms hanging around, and those are the ones you got to work with, you know? So I think the peaceful parenting thing, like we would call ourselves One Free Family, and the Facebook page is One Free Family, a new take on peaceful parenting.
You know? Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that. A new take.
A new take. That's what it is.
Yeah. So one of the things that really connected me to the show is both of you guys have experience working with young people long before you were actually parents, right? Mm-hmm. And I was in the same position.
That's right.
And you guys have talked in the show about approaches to dealing with kids, including discipline, that you would not stand by now, and how to, I guess, process those things, how to remember those things and how to process those things. And I just did so much of that, you know, so much of that reflection, but also so much of that. I don't want to use a word like regret, but so many things happened in my career between like the year 2000 and 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Man, if I could do them differently, I would. But I want to talk about that in more detail as the show goes on. But let's start at around that time for both of you. Not only did you have this experience working with young people in a camp setting, but you were both going to be school teachers, public school teachers at one point.
Yeah, I was for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
I was in a private school, actually, but yep.
But yeah, an elementary school, traditional paradigm, the whole thing.
So we're talking what, mid first decade?
Yeah, that was like 2005 to 2009.
Yeah, when I taught, 2004, like 5 to 9, yeah.
Yeah.
And you talked about this the last time you were on the show, James, that you were trained, but what then went in another direction.
Yeah, exactly. I kept my fingers in camping, which is where, you know, we met each other and had done a lot of the work together and a lot of the reflection on how we hope to work with kids. But no, I never, after my student teaching, never went back into the classroom.
Okay.
You were sooner to become a rebel than me.
So I'm curious. I'm going to, very open-ended question. What changed? Did it happen for both of you at the same time? And I know that, James, you said that School Sucks was influential for you, and I'm not fishing for School Sucks plugs here. So everybody who's listening to this is already aware of School Sucks. So I'd also like to know, in what changed, like, what were some of the other influences? What did you read? What did you see? Good, Tell. Yeah.
So the first big change for me was just having our first son. That changed. I mean, so many people will say, like, you have your first kid and your whole life changes. But he changed everything for me. I was about 3 or 4 years into teaching and had him. And I went back to work when he was 5 months old, and we had him in a little in-home daycare. And he hated it. He hated being dropped off every single day. And he hated a lot of things that we tried to do with him. We were still trying all of the mainstream parenting things that you're told you're supposed to do with babies. And nothing was working for him. He was just really opinionated. He was really adamant that he wanted to be with me. So that's what I think first, that was like the first thing that happened that kind of started changing my thinking about a lot of things in regards to kids. And then I think what really drove it home was that year he was in daycare and I was back at school, and I was at an in-service in my school, and they showed us Schools Kill Creativity, the RSA animate with Sir Ken Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
They showed us this in our in-service in the school that I worked at, and that talk just like blew it wide open for me. They showed us this encouraging us to be more creative in our classrooms, and at the time I was teaching math to fifth graders, and I was supposed to be following a day-by-day curriculum. So they were telling me to be more creative and showing me this video, but I really didn't have any space to do that. So I like drove home faster than usual that day, I think, from work. And I was like, James, you have to watch this. And he watched it. And then we just went down the rabbit hole, I think.
So did you feel like that presentation was obligatory? Because I had or that they were just doing it as a matter of procedure or something? Because I remember having the same experience in graduate school. And the one phrase that I remember using, which was, you know, really hot 15 years ago, was think outside the box.
Yeah.
I'm like, even at the time, I was like, what do they think we're going to do? You know, like, where do they think we're going? I mean, everybody in the class with me, they were already public school teachers in Massachusetts and New York, which at the time were not very friendly to teachers because of, you know, the standardized testing and the sort of classroom inspection that was going on. So I'm in a classroom surrounded by people who are complaining about the strict and sort of suffocating nature of the schools, and we're being told to think outside that box. And I just didn't know what to do with that.
Right.
So
what can you do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, there was just a small, slight difference maybe for me because I was in a private school, we weren't bound by the New Jersey, this was New Jersey, but by the state regulations, we didn't have to do the standardized testing. So there was a little bit more wiggle room at my school.
Mm-hmm.
And I could definitely see differences there, you know, from what I knew of public school growing up to public school. But again, and it was actually only a select few of us that had been chosen to go to this in-service. They'd hired this consultant, this education consultant to come in, and they chose a few of us from this school to come. But each of us taught a different thing. And so for me, particularly when I'd been given a math curriculum that we had just adopted that we were supposed to use basically word for word, it just felt like my hands were tied. What am I supposed to do with this information?
Yeah, and I think that's actually so much of the issue is that I think a lot of people in schooling recognize that it's not working, right? And they recognize that things ought to be better. And they can even push themselves far enough to say, we really should be doing different things. We're not doing the right things. But so much of the box is just so opaque that thinking outside the box might mean like giving a little bit of extra reading time. Or, you know, like they're making these really
Sure to differentiate to different kind of...
Yeah, teach to different learning styles. That's a classic one that I learned when I was going through my student teaching too, right? It's like some kids will learn more using their bodies, do more group projects. And it's like nobody's questioning the fundamental assumption that adults should be teaching kids things that adults find to be important, right? No one's having the conversation of, well, we have 30 kids coming to class. I wonder what those kids want to learn this year. Those words will never pass a teacher's lips. And until you get that far, you're not going to ever think outside of the most important box in education, in my opinion.
Well, the revolution that I guess they anticipated when I was training to be a teacher was student-centered education. That's as far as it went towards self-directed learning, a term that I don't think any of us heard when we were training to be teachers. There was no talk about homeschooling. There was no talk about Sudbury. But I remember a lot of the people instructing me, they were very pro on constructivism and the idea of student-centered learnings. But that was as close as we got to anything that, you know, I'm promoting now.
Well, it's funny. I can recall very distinctly being in my it's not my student teaching class, just my education classes in college, and having the professor, one in particular, she had these like 9 new hot ways to educate people or whatever. It's probably something she just picked up at a conference or in a paper somewhere. And yeah, they were things like kind of what you're talking about, you know, constructivism, just giving kids a little bit more autonomy maybe, but like again, working in groups, stuff that would not seem revolutionary by any stretch, but felt revolutionary to her since it was the end of her educational career. But the issue, I mean, even she taught us in a PowerPoint presentation while everyone tried hard not to fall asleep, right? Like she didn't actually put us through the paces. And when we went into our classes, that was really where we learned what was what, right? Because I went into my student teaching assignment in particular to teach English. And I remember I was teaching The Crucible. Yeah, The Crucible. And one of the lessons, I made a PowerPoint presentation, just this little super crude, sort of animated-ish PowerPoint thing with things popping up on the screen and the picture of the guy hopping along on the bottom. And my student teacher host was aghast at this. She said the kids were distracted by the PowerPoint, which is to say she was so confused that the kids were paying attention to the lesson that was going on. But she thought it was beside the point. She thought that we weren't going to be able – that they weren't actually reading and that was somehow wrong. And so, yeah, we were given the tools. But when you walk into student teaching, you're not empowered to put any of those into practice.
No, absolutely not.
No, you need to fall in line with kind of what your host teacher wants you to do.
Yeah, right. She literally plunked down a 2-inch thick textbook and was like, now we're going to teach the difference between who and whom. And I was like, okay, we'll do that instead. And it just wasn't being Robin Williams in the Dead Poets Society. It was just being another guy that I would have hated when I was in high school. You know,
absolutely. So back to the origin, you see this RSA video, you bring it to James, and what happens next for you when you see it, and where do you guys go from there?
Well, what happens for me is I'm really drawn to countercultural ideas, I think, in general. I am predisposed to being contrarian, which actually can hurt me as much as it can help me sometimes,
yes.
I think. But in that moment, a light bulb went off. And I think the biggest thing was I felt confused why no one had ever brought this up before, you know, why no one had really put, like when we think about creativity, the process of generating ideas that have value and bringing those to the world. And we think about how that's done in schools, which is come into this art class and make a craft, you know, like that's really the
that's
only time.
That's your creativity time.
Yeah. You get like 30 minutes with your weird art teacher and she's going to teach you how to do some craft that you don't care about. That's not really creativity. And he was talking about it in a different way. And I think it actually made me feel validated in my own life in some way too. Like
sure.
I was like, oh, I wasn't broken when I was a part of the schooling environment. It was that they actually hadn't figured out something that really spoke to me. And from there, you know, I was working from home. The internet rabbit hole on self-directed learning opened itself up pretty readily at that point. We watched a great documentary called Surfwise too, which was another one that I think
have
a lot of people...
One?
The family that just goes and surfs.
And surf. And they were weird. And we didn't aspire to go and be the Surfwise family, I don't think. They had maybe their own issues as well that you could pick up in the documentary. But I think it really opened up this idea that you didn't have to just lead the life that everyone leads.
Right.
You know, I think that was something we had never really ever thought critically about for some reason. Even when we were doing, like when we were living out west and being in ski towns and taking summers off to keep working at camp, we always knew we would quote unquote grow up someday. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we grew up, then we just slid right into the, you know, same suburb that I grew up in, doing all the same stuff. You're working, we have the kid, and we're like, what do people do with the kid? Oh, I know, you make him sleep in a crib and just whatever things people do, just total default mode. And that, I don't know, just took me out of that stupor, I think.
Yeah. And I think at the same time, I was starting to come across, you know, I was trying to figure out what was going on. Like, why is my instinct telling me to parent my kid in a way that most of society tells me is wrong? And so I was stumbling upon like attachment parenting ideas and things like that. And then some of those blogs led to like one of them specifically led us to the term unschooling. And so then we were able to start researching that and learning
about
what that
was. Now I have something I can Google. Exactly.
Yeah, right. Therefore, that's good to know. that's how, you know, it's interesting about the Sir Ken Robinson video. Just to think about how confronting that would be to see as a teacher or a parent, if that was your introduction to this world. Because when I found it, or when people started sending it to me, you know, I'd already been doing the show for like a year, which means I had been, you know, digging into this stuff for a number of years. So it was just reinforcement for me.
Right.
But then I started thinking about, like, we mentioned creativity in school, and the way it's kind of boxed, right? I actually found those creative classes in school to be some of the most like procedure oriented and strict. Like I remember ceramics and being like, dude, it's just clay. Like, we're just like, this is, we think that, you know, we're sitting actually now at tables with our peers and we can talk while we work.
Right.
This seems like it should be really fun. You're making it not fun. Like,
we don't need to sell these bowls.
Or, you know, I'm doing something with my hands. I'm not in a row. This is fantastic. But it was almost like the potential freedom and creativity of that situation, you know, and maybe I just didn't have the best teachers, but I feel like it was across any sort of creative opportunity that existed in school, you know, or at least, you know, on the surface, it was supposed to be creative. That was when they were like, okay, this is where we're actually giving the kids some freedom. So they really need
now
to be in our shadow.
Be creative for a moment.
Well,
right.
Yeah. I think that it's scary. I think when you're entrenched in the model of, and you could be a really, really caring teacher, but the model is kind of you're one teacher and you have all these kids in your classroom. And you've got to keep some, you know, you have this feeling that you've got to keep some level of order and control.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you're saying, you know, you're in this space where it's time to be quote unquote creative. But I think that can generate a lot of fear for the grown up in the classroom.
Sure.
Like I can't let the reins go too much or I'm just going to lose them all.
Mm. Well, and it's also, it goes against the purpose of school, you know, and I hate to be cynical and I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but society doesn't need an abundance of creative people. Like, I love what you said about creativity, James. It's the generation of new ideas that other people would find exciting or useful, right?
Yeah.
Maybe one in every 100 or even one in every 1,000 people need to have that skill. You know, everybody else needs to.
Right.
Yeah, from a central planner's perspective.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not something that is, I mean, it's you pay lip service to it.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Right. But you don't actually promote out of the box term I learned in graduate school.
Well, you don't actually create an environment in which it can thrive.
Well, exactly.
I think that's a good point because the most creative among us in at least our society that does enjoy a relative amount of freedom compared to the rest of the world and a relative amount of abundance will fight through all the ardors of school and come out quote unquote okay on the other side, right? Like you're still going to get the Mark Zuckerbergs or, you know, whoever your person is that comes in and innovates in a space and is able to take a step back and be like, this whole school thing is BS, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't really need this. You know, they'll kind of step past it and innovate anyway. The real question is how many other innovators are just underneath the surface who's innovation is stifled by this environment.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you think about the kind of macabre feeling in an art class in high school, it's pretty amazing, though, right? Because, like, in some ways, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's like we can take something that's so much fun and so invigorating as creating a clay pot or a ceramic pot with your own hands, and we can even make that boring. So when you go the other direction and you – and because everyone, I think, in our society basically assumes that learning math and learning language has to be boring, because by contrast, those were like really boring, learning a foreign language,
right.
You know, things that are so dry and so terrible.
It's really good if it's painful too.
Exactly. Well, that's
– Well, you learn important lessons that way.
Well, that's by design that it's painful. But what we've seen when helping our kids to be more self-directed in their learning is that the same, you know, excitement that someone can bring to an artistic creation, you can actually bring that to learning math or to learning a language or learning to read. And it's actually like way worse than I think most people even realize, because most people can sit back and be like, shouldn't art class be more fun? But they would never even allow themselves the thought that like algebra could be really, really fun if someone were interested in learning it, you know?
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
That's the saddest part.
Let's extend this creativity discussion into what you guys actually do now, like up to the present day. And Taylor, I heard you say in one of the shows that living life this way has actually made you more creative in the way you approach problems. Once you're kind of off the tracks of being a, like when you talked about, you know, being a young mother and okay, what am I supposed to do? What you know, and kind of realizing that everything you're told you're supposed to do is not really making your child happy, right? It's not really making you happy. So what else can you do? But once you're off those rails, you know, you're really on your own and you do need to be more creative in your approach to solving certain types of problems or addressing certain types of challenges that might even, I think that episode wasn't justifying our parenting choices. It was
owning.
Yeah. Yes. Owning our,
and then unusual parenting,
unusual parenting choices. That was, I'm determined not to use my notes. but you talked about, you know, confronting questions. Well, what would you do if this happens?
Right.
And
Well, now we can just point them to the podcast because
you want to know what I would do?
Is by and large answering those types of questions. But yeah, sorry, you were saying.
Can you think of some examples of creative approaches to some of these questions that you've encountered?
Yeah.
Or questions that you get frequently that are, I know you said you don't typically like to engage with people who are trying to be, who are asking questions in like a confrontational way.
Sure.
But people do have challenging questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, another thing that you guys pointed out is we don't have all the answers at the ready for some of these questions. You know, this is part of the podcast is trying to figure these things out. So what are some examples of maybe frequent questions or frequent, I guess, objections come in the form of questions to some of the things you're doing?
Yeah, I think there's so many. And I think you're right that it's true what I said. That's good. I still believe what I said a few weeks ago. I do think like one really freeing thing about going down this path is that I've realized that I don't have to have an answer to every challenging thing that comes up with my kids.
Right.
I don't have to have an answer right away because more often, almost never is it an emergency, and we can just kind of brainstorm together as a family. And there's a lot of freedom in being able to say, okay, like we're not where we want to be with this one particular issue right now, but I'm going to sit with that discomfort and I'm going to accept it and recognize it and then work to make us feel better. But I'm really going to like work on something that feels good for everyone instead of kind of bringing down the hammer on something just because it'll make me feel like the problem is solved. I guess a question that a lot of people ask, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this too, James, is like, how will your kids ever learn to buckle down and do something hard if they're never required to kind of do tedious work or they're never required to do boring schoolwork? How will they learn to persevere?
Right. Yeah, sure.
That one, I feel like I'm never good at answering people's questions right on the spot.
Oh, you're better than you think.
I know.
Because you've done it a lot, like with especially family members early on. I feel like it happens less now.
Like it does happen less now. I feel like now that our kids are growing up and we're just like appear to be doing all right and our kids are happy and thriving. But
like right before kids are school age, we get people that'll approach us and they'll say, or they would say, well, like, what if your kid, if reading is just too much of a hassle. So like,
yeah, they don't want to work hard on it.
Never decides to learn to read because it's too tedious. Cause they're picturing their process of learning to read. Right.
And
they're picturing, I think in many ways they're picturing all the skills that they've developed over time. And they can also trace back to some really tedious time where they were put through drilling when they first encountered that skill in the first place, right? So how do our kids do it?
I think I would answer that now, having, you know, being 8 years into, or I guess seven, when we really decided to start parenting this way, into doing this, is that I've just seen my kids buckle down and work hard on things. And every time they've done it, it's because it's mattered to them. You know, it hasn't been because I've said it's time that you figure this out or that you work hard on this. It's because it's really been, they've been intrinsically motivated to accomplish a goal or do something really hard or finish a project. And so for me, I just don't live in fear of that because I see them doing that every day. And I have to believe that that every person in the world wants to be, you know, as they grow, they want to feel successful and they want to be able to support themselves and take care of themselves so that they can get what they want in life. So I have to believe that as my kids grow, and they want certain things, they want to buy certain things, they want to live certain lifestyles, that they are going to decide it's important enough to buckle down and do some hard work to make that possible for themselves, because I've seen them do it time and again. I don't know. Do you have a better way of?
Well, I think, well, the buckling down question, it's almost an issue of begging the question, right? It's someone saying, since working really hard on things you don't like is important, how are your kids learn that skill eventually, right? And, you know, one thing we've talked about when you're parenting kids in a more self-directed way is trying to come to grips with the idea that, like, your kid, if you never tell them that they should value themselves based on how hard they work, they might actually grow up to not want to work very hard, you know? And that, I think, is okay. That's just a different way of being and processing the world. Now, I personally get a lot of fulfillment out of working hard and a job well done. And I see that especially in one of our sons very much. Like, when he has a goal and something to work on, he will work on it. And there's no reward. We don't give him any presents for it. The things he does have no payoffs, and they don't really make his life better outside of the individual fulfillment.
Outside of how it feels to him.
So for him anyway, he likes the process. It was born into him for whatever reason, this process of feeling proud at a job well done. But for other people, like, I remember when we lived in ski towns, there was a guy I remember meeting who was a bartender in that ski town. And I remember thinking, being so judgmental of this guy, like, what's his deal? How could he be 45 and still be a bartender in this ski town? But that guy, for the last 25 years of his life, had woken up and skied 5 days a week and bartended and hung out with his friends, and he was in great shape, and he had a funny, nice wife, and
he was happy.
He seemed really happy. But in my mind, I was like, what a loser, you know? But I wasn't really like that. All those repetitions, all of the hearings I heard in school of, you will be a loser unless you
all
do this.
All the value that was placed on so being one way.
I just want to be comfortable realizing that, like, our kids might even reject societal norms that we haven't rejected, that we don't even know are societal norms, you know? And I think that's part of the cool learning process of being a parent this way.
And I like that you said that they just may not, you know, some kids may just not grow up to be ones who want to work really, really hard. And I think that's okay, because I still believe that growing up in the environment that they are, that they will find a way to work hard enough to support themselves. Like, I really, really do believe that. I don't feel worried that they're going to be trying to figure out how to make ends meet because they've never learned to put their heads down and work.
Well, which one of the three is the one that you say really takes pleasure in a job well done?
The oldest one, who you just got to meet moments ago. He was in the process of one of the things he's working on really hard right now, which is the video game Overwatch. And he actually first learned it on our Xbox upstairs. Then he found out that the pro players play on the computer. And so he scrapped all of his experience on the Xbox. We got the computer, and he's been slowly working his way back up on that. But it's like, I mean, these days he's not doing it quite as much, but there were times where he would put in easily 8 hours total in the day between study and practice on this game. And, you know, at that point he had reached, like on the Xbox, for instance, he reached a point where he was competing with the top 10% of all players of the 40 million people that have bought that game. And most of whom are in their 20s, and he was 6 at the time. And so for him, and it's really hard, and the game is brutal, and you'll just get killed 50 times in a row. No one cares. No one apologizes. There's no, you know, participation trophies.
There's no funerals.
No, there's not. It's just, you can turn the game back on and play again, or you don't. And for him, he's just like, he is constantly searching for, maybe we can even get into the technology thing, because for him, he's constantly searching for these appropriate challenges that are put him just on the threshold of something he can do, but needs to work just a little bit harder, where his decisions and his actions really matter.
Do you feel like he envisions what's at the end of that? Like, what does he do it with a goal in mind? And the reason why I ask is, you know, when it comes to this question that you first brought up of, like, well, if they don't learn how to persevere through things that suck, you know, how prepared are they going to be for life? You know, I think about what I do. What I do is very self-directed. I do it exactly the way I want to do it. It's intrinsically motivated. And parts of it suck. You know, parts of it are not. It was not fun spending hours and hours as a non-writer. And I know you're not supposed to tell yourself that when you're learning to write. you know, optimizing one out of 1,000 pages on the website to try and get the, what's it called? The Fleshler readability score up to a certain level. Right, right. I'm just rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting until it scores the way I want it to score. Uh-huh. And then I was like, great, that's 1/1,000th of the website. Wasn't a particularly satisfying day, even though I knew it was an important page and I knew it was an important project. So parts of this are not fun, but the whole thing is fun. And having a vision for the whole thing helps me, even though I picked up a lot of really bad habits as far as work and attitudes towards work are concerned across my life, both from school and from early professional experience. Now, I mean, I recognize that, and I need to recognize more of this, I think, honestly, but persevering through difficult challenges has rewards if the bigger picture is something that you're really excited about. So have you seen that? I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about, that there's recognition that, like, yeah, this isn't the most fun part of this, but I know where this is going.
Well, I think for him, anyway, it's the journey and the destination.
Sure. You know,
it's like, and I think that this is something I try to examine in my own self every day, too, where it's like, there are, like, I believe that there are probably ways I could spend my time that would earn me money that would be really hard, but I also would enjoy most of the hard parts, you know, and not all of them. And I've worked multiple careers now. Like, I'm remembering playing poker professionally, for instance, and I enjoyed almost all of the process of becoming an expert level poker player. You know, there were definitely times where the job was hard and demanding and made me very upset and all those other things, but I don't, and while I was doing it, I think I also knew that I wanted to be able to do it well enough to make a living at it. But I think the process was fun and it felt more worth it because the journey was pleasurable, right? And so he definitely has milestones he aims for, like, I want to get this rating, or, you know, even think about potentially one day being a professional video gamer in some capacity. But I think for him, it's a lot more about, like, being in the moment and the playful aspect of, like, you know, it's like why kids play with puzzles or, like, fiddle with a Rubik's Cube. It's like, yeah, they would love to complete it, but it's also like the play of being in the moment.
Being in flow.
Is worth it.
Right? Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's a good point. Absolutely. Do you guys feel like there's any other unusual parenting choices that were difficult to own? Maybe even just at some point, like something that you guys had to get through.
Well, do you want to talk about the technology thing? Because I feel like that's one we've gone back and forth on a ton.
Yeah.
The screens, right? So this is another episode of your podcast. Yeah. And this has been a subject of debate on my show as well.
Yeah. And I heard you talk about it a little bit with Peter Gray on that episode. And I've read pretty much probably everything he's written on screens and everything else he's written. But
and you've read most things that have been written about screens in general because...
Yeah. That's been a really hard one for me. So I think... you know, listening to a little bit of some of your skepticism, I really resonated with it because I have been in that place and sometimes still go to that place. It's been a long journey for me. And I think part of it came from, you know, when I started reading about, I mentioned reading about attachment parenting, kind of the people who were practicing attachment parenting, most of them were also falling into like natural parenting circles and Waldorf and like places where screens are really, really demonized almost, not even maybe some, you know, more than even just kind of questioning them the way that I hear you do or that I do, but really demonizing
them. Like nature deficit disorder.
Yeah. People. And so I was, you know, starting off my parenting journey kind of in that place of like, let's keep them away from screens as long as possible. Like I really was starting there and I was really worried about what it would do to their brains. And I would say it's really only been in like the past year that I've really, I think I still have room to grow, but that I've really come to actually see and believe in the value of what they're doing, of what my kids are doing when they're using screens, whether they're playing video games or watching, you know, watching other people play video games.
That's a good one that a lot of people can't understand.
Yeah. And like, I've actually, when James was talking about our oldest son, setting these goals in this video game and how he was, you know, spending 8 hours a day either playing or studying. When he was studying, he was like watching his favorite people on YouTube play these games and analyze their own play or people analyzing other people's play. And he was so actively engaged in that process. It was a really different thing than walking in a room and seeing somebody kind of half paying attention, eyes glazed over. Like he
watching
was
watching surprise eggs videos.
Yeah. He was super, super engaged. Yeah. And that was how he studied. And I think part of how I started to come around was I also realized that because of just time and how fast technology changes and what technology was like when we were all kids, it's like this wasn't a thing. And so there's no script for it. And so it can feel really scary. Like there was no YouTube. People weren't learning things on YouTube. And now we all use YouTube to learn so many things. Like, how do I fix the lawnmower? Let me go see if there's a good YouTube video. And when I say I really mean James. Yeah. I did not do that. You know, how do I learn this new like knitting stitch? I look up for a YouTube video.
Yeah.
Also James, no. But starting to realize that this is just like a way that people are engaging the world that actually has a lot of value, and seeing how much they have learned from it has helped me to come around, as well as just like joining them and seeing all of the social interaction and connection that happens when we actually just play together. That's done a lot for helping me to see the value.
Yeah. And I think you're speaking to, it's a really common boogeyman to just call something screen time and just overgeneralize every single activity that can be done using a screen. Because like I personally see a lot of difference in working really hard on a challenging video game that requires you to think and problem solve and use math and language skills and all those things. That to me is just a very different activity than like passively just clicking on the next YouTube video of like grown-ups dressed in superhero costumes, you know, running around on the screens, right? Like there's a whole spectrum of things. And I have actually come to see more value in even things that seem very inane to me. I imagine it probably looked like what, you know, I don't know, people watching Ren and Stimpy looked like to my parents or something growing up. Like, you know, there have always been, adults have never really understood the hobbies and interests of children is the big takeaway for me.
It's an interesting thing now that we are adults and we're all of the same, we're about the same age. Yeah. We're certainly of the same generation. And in those formative years of my life, I would say our generation was arguably in the last 100 years, the most impacted by the evolution of the screen.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, between the ages of me being 5 and 10, maybe, 5 and 10 years old, we went from having 10 television channels to all of a sudden we had VCRs, and then we had cable, and then we had Nintendo.
Right.
You know, and this was, you know, I know video games predate that by a lot, even at home, but like the immersive experience of the screen in my childhood, I think a lot of people in our age range could look at that. I mean, we were more affected by screens than maybe, I mean, you might have to go back to like the 1920s and the advent of like being able to go and watch a movie in a theater, you know, to think about a generation that, you know, had something so, or so many things so alien introduced. But what these kids are experiencing is even off the charts, I would say, compared to that.
It's
wild. Well, and that's the scary thing.
And that could scare us,
Yeah, exactly.
Parenting in general, right? Because like everyone who's a parent, especially going forward, this will become more and more true as we advance through time, will be parenting in a totally different world than they grow up in.
You know? Yeah.
And I think this was especially difficult for like all of our parents, right? Like even when I was growing up, you couldn't really, like Saturday morning cartoons would end at noon and then you could watch like American Gladiators.
Right. There was just nothing else on that you'd want to
watch. But after that, you were like going to go outside because it was like soap operas and all this like boring stuff. There was no option to sit and like binge watch your favorite show.
Right.
And so we went outside, but that was still scary for our parents. Right. And so the world has changed so much even since then that we're just going to be like all the other parents. You know, like a great podcast for people to check out is the Pessimist Archive. You know, the Pessimist Archive, if you ever encountered this one?
No.
It's really good. Yeah. It goes back and it just highlights people being scared of all sorts of technologies, from like electricity to books.
Books, yeah, novels, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, novels, they're just going to have people, the written word is going to kill the oral tradition, and it's going to make people sit in corners and not talk to one another, right?
Right, right.
What's with kids and all this reading? They're going to be antisocial and never make friends. Like the list goes on, right? And so I want to be very, I want to embrace the fear of parenting in what is now the biggest ongoing experiment in human history. What's it like to raise kids with technology? Nobody knows, you know,
we're
not going to know. And by the time our kids are 30, they're going to have virtual reality and they're going to say kids with their virtual reality headsets, they can never go outside, you know, who knows. Right.
And
so instead I'd rather have my family live under the understanding that the world will continue changing. So how can we all be adaptable in what will be a changing world rather than trying to stick all my fingers in the dikes of progress and be like, you know, we're just not going to have new technology in our house, or like, you know, I know the exact arbitrary amount or type of technology that they interact with. You know, I don't know. That seems like a more sustainable long-term gift to give my kid than some temporary restriction on what they should pursue.
So it brings up an interesting question.
Let's go.
In one word. Well, we'll start with a word.
Yeah.
And it's a word that the two of you, I've learned from listening to the podcast, feel differently about. Structure.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the optimistic view of screens is like this is an amazing window to the world, mm-hmm. right? And maybe the more cynical view is like, yeah, but it's not the world. Mm-hmm. And I actually realized, like, in my mid to late 30s, making more of a conscious effort to unplug mm-hmm. and go outside and try to appreciate certain things. But there's, I guess, the challenge of finding the balance between the two, because I needed the screens for work mm-hmm. and for all, almost most entertainment. Mm. But I also started to get a pleasure and a satisfaction from the life I was living away from them. So when it comes to structure, all right, so I'll even think like it's scientifically about this, like something like blue light, you know, like if I'm sitting in front of the computer till midnight, I know I'm not going to fall asleep until two. Because my circadian rhythms are getting screwed up by mm-hmm. staring at this blue light. Mm. And now I could put a filter. I mean, I have the filter on the computer, so I guess I could stare at it.
But you have those glasses. Too.
Yeah, I have the glasses. Okay. Yeah, I had a, I had a young
do you
man.
Feel like a hacker when you're wearing those? Like
you've seen them, the red glasses?
Yeah, exactly.
I had an 18-year-old on my show, didn't go to college, and actually started a business making those glasses when he learned about all of this.
Sweet.
Yeah, so I've been wearing them at night. I enjoy them, and I think they're pretty cool. I think they're pretty cool looking.
I think you should wear them during the day. But that's just me.
I think you can put them on when the sun starts to set.
Okay.
And you know, so you have to wait till like 7 to like start looking really
it's
cool.
It's like the reverse of sunglasses.
Father's Day is coming up. We can
that's a good call.
Chew pear.
You don't want to be caught with a guy with the red computer glasses in the middle of the day.
Right.
So yeah, around structure and balance. I mean, you know, we met each other, like we mentioned, at a summer camp where we would go, even in the prime of my poker career where I was playing mostly online, we would go and completely unplug in a place that had
all summer.
No Wi-Fi. I mean, yeah, you would have no Wi-Fi at all, right? That was like even pre-cell phone. And we would just be there all summer, totally unplugged and living that. And I think we have our cred when it comes to enjoying the outdoors. You know, we lived in ski towns, we hiked, boat, we do all that stuff. And we really value those. And we would, I don't know, I would like for my kids to value those things too. But do you want to talk about like how we've actually arrived at a place? I feel pretty good about where we are
now.
Yeah,
me too.
But talk about how we arrived there.
Well, I think when you think about, you know, structure and balance and balancing, you know, using screens for things and doing other things, I've come to believe that I really want my kids to find what feels good to them in terms of balance with that. We all have a different level of what feels good to us. And I know that I've definitely gone through times where I've been like, man, I just need to, like you said, I would feel better if I unplugged a little bit more and
sure.
went outside.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if that's just if I actually feel that way or if I just feel guilty.
You're like secretly pleasing the authority figures that
yeah,
always told
exactly,
you to grow up.
Yeah, exactly, because I've always been tried to be a people pleaser. But but I really want our kids to be able to find their own balance and find what feels good to them. And so I think that we've tried to give them freedom, but freedom with support, like freedom with us. We're there with them every step of the way to like notice like, oh, you've been playing that game for like, you know, that really competitive, intense game for a few hours now. And I'm noticing now you're starting to get a little bit frustrated or you're kind of snapping at your brother. Like, do you think you might need a break? Are you hungry? And I've really seen, again, especially the oldest, just I think it's age and maybe partly personality, but Even the middle one, like I've really seen them start to recognize those things for themselves. Like recently, even the oldest in the mornings, because they usually wake up before I do, has been like, oh, mommy, I just really need to eat some food. Like I can feel myself kind of getting frustrated with my brother or whatever. And I'm seeing the fruits of basically giving them freedom to make their own choices and also giving them context around like why some of these things might be happening or why they might be feeling what they're feeling.
Or teaching them the science of like your body will produce vitamin D when you're in the sun. You don't know what that means, but like that can be something really highly correlated with you feeling happier or feeling, you know, more
able to handle problems.
Exactly.
And or instead of being told you have to go outside, like I was, to so you can have the same attitude that you have about reading, you know, and movement. What was the other one we were talking about? Learning math or ceramics, right?
Well, I think it is important to expose kids to it, right? Like I think sometimes people get a vision of having self-directed kids or unschooling, if you'd like to call it that. And they picture like your kid is there and then you're just like standing there quietly waiting. Like, what is the kid going to do? And
right.
you just like follow them around and you're, you know, this little mouse in the corner and then you bring them snacks and then you just like, but it's like, no, we are people that are passionate and have interests.
We're like, hey, we're going outside to shoot hoops. Who wants to come with us?
Yeah. Like, or like now Ali comes on walks every day, basically in the morning.
Grabs his scooter and
goes around the block with me and my parents and the baby and the dog. And it's a whole thing. Or like, you know, also, I think when it comes to being outside, some ways of being outside are more fun to more people. So like I was really really insistent almost on like getting the kids to come out and try skiing with us once, right? Like, come on out because this is something I enjoy so much and I think you're going to like it too. And then sure enough, they loved it. And now they really love to go outside, even in the dead cold in the middle of New Hampshire, in, you know, the top of this mountain with the wind blowing, because skiing is a fun way to be outside, right? So
where do you guys go, by the way?
Oh, we go to Gunstock normally because they've got good small person hills on there.
And it's so close.
I grew up at King Pine. Have you ever been there?
No.
I don't even remember. It's up when it's... it doesn't matter. No one cares.
on our international audience. So we wanted to pick somewhere, you know, it's like 45 minutes away.
Yeah, so like if you picture our interaction with our kids is like spreading out a buffet, right? Like we want to spread out Indian food and Thai food and pizza and spaghetti and like whatever else. And hopefully mostly nutritious options as far as the information available to us at the time. But when they go and put all the food on their plate and bring it back, we don't want to be like, why did you get that stuff? You know,
yeah.
Like, why'd you bring me to the buffet then if you didn't, like if I couldn't get the food I wanted? And we want to be intentional about thinking, well, what are all the different things that we could present to them that we could lay out and help them to encounter? And then the difficult work begins after that.
I was just going to say, yeah, then doing the inner work of like, okay, they are being presented with a really wide range of options. And then I'm going to try to not be attached to the choices that they make because it's their choice to make. And it's not for lack of options, right? We know that we're providing them with all of these different things and they may not choose what we would choose. And that's okay.
Yeah. Like the colored pencils don't get a lot of play. I see them sitting over there.
Our kids just don't love to draw. Right. But it's there. Yeah. And Ezzy drew a picture this morning, you know, randomly. So
yeah, exactly.
But they get to see the cause and effect of their own decisions.
Yeah.
And the freedom that they have, I think, and you touched on this briefly, kind of allows them to attune to themselves better and to attune to their own needs, it seems like.
That's the experiment, right?
I mean,
the idea being that everyone I know who's – all the grownups I know who are leading a more self-actualized life went through this process – after they were done with all their schooling, pretty
indeed.
Much. Like, I don't really know any of my friends who are, you know, say like entrepreneurs or doing something sort of off the beaten path or world travelers who like walked right out of school and were like, I know what I'll do. I'll lead a really happy life where I do work that I'm passionate about and that fills me up and pays the bills. It was like, nope, I went and did a bunch of other things. I sat around and just thought and eventually became so dissatisfied with the life that I had been building up toward that I just said enough is enough and tried something new. And the hope for our kids, and I think for many self-directed kids, would be that they're going through that process now.
Yeah.
You know, that right now is the time, like I took in the first 6 years of my 20s, where they're going like, huh, I'm kind of bored. This isn't really fulfilling me. What should I be doing? Why don't I experiment with this? Why don't I experiment with that? And not telling themselves.
Why don't I go like ask these people who I trust for some ideas?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Going through that when they have the financial support of their parents and when their brains are developing and, you know, really latching onto these skills. You know, I think a lot of people come in, and one of the concerns that we've brushed up against, for instance, is, oh, well, like if your kid doesn't learn a foreign language when they're young, that will be harder when they're grown ups, you know, when their minds are more firmed up. Well, what if they don't learn to be self-directed when they're young? What happens when they're grown ups? Is that also like a hardened neurological pathway that they can't get back? Who knows, right? So I think that's what I would hope to shoot for, is like kids that practice the hard work of being self-directed and making decisions now, so that when they're our age, that they're like, yeah, I've been doing this forever. Like, what do you mean you can't figure out what you want to do? Like, I know how to do that now.
And maybe then they also, I mean, I don't want to be naive. I'm sure that they're going to struggle with things, but maybe then they also don't have all of the baggage that comes with breaking away from kind of falling in line and doing what's expected of you, right? Like, we've come to, all of us, I think, have come to kind of a self-directed way of living. But at least for me, it did come with some baggage of like, am I going to disappoint people by doing this thing that's really different? And what does it actually mean to be true to myself and to how I want to spend my time? And hopefully, because this is just a natural way of living for our kids, maybe they won't have to kind of overcome that additional hurdle.
It can come with a lot of resentment too, right? When you're with that, I mean, that's a huge part of that baggage of disconnecting or charting a new path from the way you've always been told to do everything, you know? People can certainly, and I mean, I went through this, so I assume I'm not the only one, can go through a period of being really angry at the world, really angry at authority figures or any form of anything that looks like hierarchy. Is there's a hostility that grows to that as it's like taking that red pill and feeling like you've been lied to your whole life.
Absolutely.
That's something that also people bond over that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that's typical that people bond over negative things. Like, you know, when five coworkers are together and one coworker isn't there, guess who those five coworkers are talking about, right? That's unfortunately a way that people connect. And I think that, you know, movements and coalitions are kind of built around this hostility and this negativity and this resentment. And that's really unfortunate. And it's one of the really encouraging things I've seen in New Hampshire, specifically with what you guys have going on in this region of New Hampshire, is that people are building a community based on something else, like from the beginning. Like maybe we all went through that, but there's different priorities now because so many of you guys have young families,
right?
You know,
and
I think that's a really wonderful thing
to see.
Based
on this excitement of kind of trying this new thing, this new way of life. And
Yeah. I think that that resentment really speaks to how I felt, I think, when I first started, like when you realize, when you look back and you're like, people ask themselves questions like, I wonder how things could have gone had I had some of that time back, you know, like that's a really incredible time investment. And I think that is, you know, it's sad. It's hard to reflect on that. But I think one of the things that motivates me most to spread the word about self-directed learning are the people who never even get there. You know, like how many friends of ours do we have that have a half-written novel on their computer that they don't finish because they feel stupid that they're writing a novel? Or, you know, the person who comes up with a business idea and they're really excited and they share it casually in a group of friends and people, you know, the kind of feeling in the group is like, well, you're never actually going to do that.
Sure.
Because I've been there on both of those specific things, right? And so many people, I think, reject their dreams because those inner voices that they've developed over decades of hearing that they should do this specific thing, almost everyone just winds up listening. And that's the saddest part to me. It's, yeah, it's one thing if you quote unquote wake up and you wind up leading this life and you have that feeling of resentment, but like, what about that very, I would imagine, very large swath of the population that never gets there, man? That's really sad.
Yeah. And, you know, it's actually, I can tie a couple of things that we've talked about into a new subject right there. Most people go to jobs and they work, and a lot of people don't like those jobs. And a lot of that grows out of the experience and the expectations and the demands of schooling. I mean, we all know that. You guys are both very self-directed in your own lives, right? And maybe that's created some opportunities for you to have the kind of family that you want with the kind of education that you want. Now, I don't think that this self-directed learning, like some people might just not thrive in that environment. Some people might need more structure. I would like to see a lot more people at least attempting to do this, you know, with their children or children like being more self-directed on their own. Like that's obviously an aspiration. Sure. Yeah.
So when you say some people might not thrive in a self-directed learning environment, I'm not sure how I feel about that statement, but I also wonder what step do you then take? Like if you had a child and you didn't feel like they were thriving in a self-directed learning environment, but they really didn't want to go into the structured, coerced, maybe too strong a word, but like, structured, forced schooling environment. Like, because that's I think the ultimate question, right? It's like, you know, do you pull the trigger at that point and just
no.
say, like, it's better for you, so here you go?
I'll tell you about something that I saw in my travels at the end of last year.
Please.
So I went to a school, it was a Sudbury-style school, and I was really, really impressed with so many of the kids who went there. Kids who came up to me, and I was there with my friend Tony when we came in the door. Like, we're adults, you know? And my experience of kids, are especially like when they're teenagers, it's like adults get away. You know, like I know what
you engage, like we're just not gonna,
we're talking about things that we're uncomfortable talking about in front of you. We just don't want you near us because
say awkward stuff like,
exactly. Yeah. Or you're going to cramp our style.
Totally.
And I deal with you people all day in a school and I've had it with your kind. I mean,
absolutely.
And that, so to have the experience of having been a teacher and tutor of teenagers and having some really challenging relationships as a teacher and some more like relationships with kids in tutoring where I really, really had to work to make a connection with them because they had expectations of me as an educational adult, you know, because there was a lot of baggage around that for them through school.
Well, most kids that have tutors already like are on some level rejecting the whole process. Right? It makes them feel worse about themselves.
The tutor, the tutor is there to fight a fire.
They're
getting the message that they're not measuring up.
Exactly.
It's a reinforcement. I mean, that's how I talked about it, that I was an enforcer for the school. Mm-hmm. In the early days of my tutoring career, I'm here because there's a problem with you,
right,
Jimmy.
Exactly.
So it was a really interesting and unique from most of my past experience to go into this school and have teenagers come up and introduce themselves and ask who I was and express what I felt was like a really genuine curiosity in me and my friend and offer to give me a tour of the school. And I was like, I started feeling very utopian. I was like, see, this is it in action.
Right.
But I have to be completely honest. We went into one room, which happened to be the computer room. It had no windows. It stunk. You know, like people who had been sitting in there all day. And the kid, one of the kids who was like this helpful, interested tour guide said, and this is the computer room. And nobody even turned to look. And maybe one or two kids even turned to look. Or some just looked up and looked back. They had no interest in who I was. And then one of them said, oh, you're here to tour the school? Or something like, I feel bad for you. Mm-hmm. And went back to what they were doing. And I said, I guess that even in an environment like this, where you give kids all this freedom for whatever reason, right? It's a dog. We're in a neighborhood. It's fine. It's not your dog. Do you have a dog?
Yeah, it's our dog.
Oh.
He's been asked to stay away.
For whatever reason, you're going to have kids who have this kind of attitude, right? That was so different from the attitudes of the kids we first encountered at the school. They were cynical. They were negative. They were sedentary. They didn't really appreciate the school. And there could have been a number of reasons. You know, it could have been things happening at home, could have been diet, could have been other emotional problems. And what I walked away from that with was, I guess there will be people who don't appreciate this, right? So that's not thriving. It doesn't mean that situation isn't better for them, right? Or they wouldn't be doing exactly the same thing. Like, well, this kid just sits here and plays computer games all day, so we better get him in a school where he can sit and stare at books. I mean, that would be terrible, you know? But I thought it was really important to have a place like that where kids who can thrive in that kind of environment with that kind of freedom weren't stuck in a school, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So maybe there are going to be children of all different ages who are just not motivated or just not interested or just don't appreciate an opportunity like that, or they don't really embrace living life that way. But gosh, for the kids that do, I really hope those opportunities exist, and I wish there were more of them.
Yeah, so I think there's actually something going on there that I want to address, because many people – so I'll relate this to something, a conversation I had when I was at the Porcupine Freedom Festival last year. I was talking to somebody about the idea of unschooling, and she made the observation that her friend – was a psychologist who had worked with a lot of kids who had dealt with psychological issues who had been unschooled. Mm. And so in this woman's mind, unschooling had potentially caused these psychological issues, right? And I as I talked to her and tried to pull out more information, because I had never heard this particular concern that, you know, unschooling will make your kids psychotic or something like that. It turned out that a lot of the kids that her friend were encountering were having troubles in the first place, and then their parents addressed the issues that they were having by an alternative approach to education, right? So, like, I do think, you know, whether you want to call them weird people or people that are really struggling in the general world, a lot of those do find self-directed learning eventually because
their parents stumble upon it.
That's what I mean.
They can't figure out how,
because
to
their
help
parents
their
finally
kids.
Say enough is enough. Like, this kid is in a fight every day at school. He gets sent to the principal's office every day. Or, you know, my kid has an extreme learning, quote unquote, learning disability that is causing conflict with the teacher every single day. So what other options do we have? Because, you know, I've known people who operate, you know, like the Philly Free School or the Circle School in PA, or even the Sudbury School in Hudson Valley. And all of them talk about this, you know, the two general classes of parents, which are, I would say, ones like us that are philosophical unschoolers, as it were, like, that come to this before we even have kids and say, yes, we'd like our kids to be self-directed. And then there's more reactionary ones who have tried a lot of other stuff and none of that's worked. And then they wind up on something self-directed, and that feels like the least bad solution.
But they have these kids who have already experienced a lot of challenges and trauma. And so now they're in these free schools, like this school that you saw. Like, I'd be really curious to know the backstory of each of those kids that you encountered. Like, were they kids who maybe had been through a more traditional schooling model and it had gone really badly for them, so their parents found this alternative school and they were still deschooling? Like, they were still going through the process of kind of becoming whole people again?
Right. So I think that, you know, one of the good things that you're doing on your show is you're taking a more holistic approach, right? You're not just talking about education. You're talking about parenting, family, activities outside of that. All of that stuff is in the process or has been addressed on your show. And I try to do the same thing. So what the experience that you had, James, at Porkfest, where somebody ties unschooling to psychological problems is obviously a very, very narrow focus. And if you're trying to do something in isolation, right, or you're trying to use one of these things as a panacea for, I'm sure that was the case with a couple of these kids. And I say that because I've worked with kids who were taken out of the school because of the emotional problems, which could have been related to, you know, actual physical things that kind of produce these emotional problems. School is a traumatic experience for this one boy I remember working with. But if somebody had encountered us working together at a particularly frustrating time, and we had great times, we made a YouTube channel where he was a magician and we studied ancient aliens and cryptids. It was amazing. But on a day where he was having a really hard time, where it was just me, a sort of tutor slash unschool facilitator, I'd work with him like 25 hours a week at the height. But he needed supervision. Yeah. You know, he was young. He was 8 or 9 years old. If somebody walked into that chaos one day, as they might label it, they would say, oh, this is what happens when you have a kid not interacting. And he did. He actually did struggle because we would try to bring in kids to do like art projects. You know, there was a group of people who were all connected around this school near Concord. He would struggle with social interactions, but the educational environment or the educational approach wasn't causal in any of his problems. So that is a good question that you asked, James, for clarification. When I say somebody's not thriving in that environment, that still could be the truth, but the environment is not necessarily the cause of it. I would say very rarely is the environment the cause, especially if that kid has something to compare a sort of self-directed environment to that isn't self-directed. They would have to think that the self-directed environment would at least be, if they were given a choice, I would think, like if I had been able to interview all of these kids in the smelly computer room, you know, I bet they would say they'd rather be in there than in a public school. Now, you could also say that thriving is very subjective, right? Like thriving, when that word comes out of my mouth, there's ideas attached to it from my head. Somebody else could have a different definition of that, for sure.
Yeah, well, it's about where I've landed in terms of the impact I hope to have in the life of a child is that the child is going to come with some sort of genetic and experiential baseline, right? So a kid comes to one of our camps, for instance, and they're going to be there for between 1 and 3 weeks. They're coming with the 15 years that they've been on Earth and all their DNA, and I get a week, right? So like, what difference do I really hope to make in the life of that child? Well, many kids are not going to come, the most cynical, rude, whatever, are not going to leave thriving as you picture it, right? And for many kids too, I think the combination of all their baseline experiences and genetics and their feelings with their parents and what they've seen on TV or whatever else, and their hormones, I think, are another big thing for you're a teenager and you're just living through the world and like, just here's another jerk who's not going to help you get a girlfriend, right? You know, just whatever is going on, right? And so I think there's so much going on in the life of a child. And I think adults in some ways hold themselves to too strict a standard in terms of, or they believe that they're capable of doing more than they really can to change
the
course.
Like how much control they can have.
Yeah, like they're picturing, I think this is actually causes so much pain in parenting and causes so much pain in the relationship between an adult and a child, which is adults, teachers, and parents, anyone, camp counselors who works with a kid, all of a sudden they view that child and who that child becomes as their responsibility, as though they're handing in a term paper. Like, I created this. What do you think? You know, that's not how children work. Like, some kids, for the most loving, sweetest, kindest, most intentional parents, are going to have kids that are going to be cynical or maybe get addicted to drugs or become homeless. Like, that will happen to some percentage. Now, we hope to move the probabilities in our favor away from outcomes like that and toward thriving outcomes. But you can never measure any approach by its best or worst examples, or even the examples that you have at your disposal. Like, if our kids grow up and are unhappy, it won't necessarily be because of what we did parenting-wise.
Although most people will say it is because we did something different.
Well, that's all they know. And actually, in some cases, you know, being a stat nerd here for a second, it probably will be because of something that we did, but you can't say it definitively. And I think all we can do is go based on what people have seen over large populations, you know, intuitively feel their way along and do their best. And I think that's ultimately what our podcast is about too, right? It's like, how are we every day trying to find a better version of our best rather than how do we find the right thing and pat ourselves on the back because we're the smartest, you know? And that's fun. I like doing that.
It is fun.
Back to that self-directed challenges thing, you know, it's being a grandmaster parent is the goal for me.
Oh, wow.
It says, it's a...
All right. Good to know.
That's also not a bad rap name.
Yeah, the grandmaster parent. I would get a lot of cred in that.
GMP. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I mean, we live in a very outcomes-focused society when it comes to children, which also like clarifies the attitudes that a lot of people have about their role and control.
Yeah.
You know, over children. Like, school is all about outcomes. So the first question that I think you would encounter when you shift into talking about alternative types of education are what happens to unschoolers?
Yeah, totally.
You know, I think Peter Gray did some sort of informal studies on that? Are you guys familiar?
Yeah, it's based on the Sudbury schools, right?
Right.
This kid went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, based on, I think, interviews, right, with what graduates were saying.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a small sample size, but I was really encouraged by a lot of what I read. I think that, is it fair to say that you are, because we think in terms of outcomes a lot, right? Mm-hmm. That you're looking at outcomes on a smaller scale. You're not saying, I'm going to take this arbitrary 18 years of the childhood of my child and make some assessment about it at the end. Like, you're looking at outcomes of actions and activities and decisions like on a daily basis and adapting through that.
Yeah, I think
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, because I think, I mean, you know, if pressed, of course, I would say that I want my kids to be, you know, happy, functioning adults. Of course, I want that. But at what cost, right? So if that's, if I'm looking at that macro outcome, which I think a lot of parents are, rightfully so, I think that that comes, I think that we can be kind of convince ourselves to make a lot of sacrifices on the part of our kids along the way, right? So if I think that that outcome is going to happen by making sure my kid has grit and making sure that my kid does really well in math and science and all of these things, then I may sacrifice a big piece of my relationship with them. I may sacrifice, you know, their ability to kind of become their authentic selves. And so, yeah, I think we're looking at it more on a, like you said, like a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. Like, how is this kind of approach that we're using working for them? Are they seeming to be meeting their needs on a weekly basis? Are they feeling healthy and happy? Are they being kind people? Are we feeling connected to them? And those, like, smaller assessments are, I think, are what drive kind of the decisions that we make as a family.
Yeah, for sure. And well, I think too, outcomes are so tricky when it comes to kids, because I think a lot of parenting or education or working with kids in general, it's akin to doing like a rain dance where you're saying like, well, we're just going to go out and dance every day and then we're going to make it rain. And then sure enough, on Friday it rains and you're like, see, there we are, you know? And you're just, it's people taking credit for most things that would happen naturally if adults stayed out of the way. Now, rain dances are pretty innocuous. You can't stop it from raining by dancing, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. But with kids, especially, like, there are steps that we can take that we know will inhibit the development of certain, what I believe to be pretty crucial things, right? Like, we can traumatize our kids by using physical violence against them, right?
Sure.
Like your kid was going to become somebody. Now he will not because you were physically violent with him. We know that in certain educational concepts, if we force our kids to learn mathematics or we force them to learn multiplication via memorization, we can inhibit their ability to, you know, when they reach the developmental milestone where they can envision what multiplying really means, they can draw on memorization and not be able to do it as well when they get there, right? So there are, and there are a number of examples like this. And I think for me, it's more of a first do no harm approach to parenting, which is to say, I have custody over this child. They're going to come through my house and I'm going to be a partner with them in life.
Yeah.
And for the most part, yeah, I've got some ideas. I can pull them out of the street if they're going to walk into oncoming traffic. I can, you know, move the heroin needle out of the way if they're going to step on it as we walk across the beach or something. But everything else, not everything else, but most things, I think, are just after that a matter of values and opinion. And I don't want to claim that my values are factual, that they're absolutely better. And so if we're talking about outcomes, I want hope to have happy and fulfilled kids pursuing things on their own terms. I hope to have a good relationship with my kids, which is something I can measure on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. I hope that my kids are treating each other and other people with kindness, generally speaking. And
I hope that they're – sorry, I just interrupted
you. And just outside of that, most things are negotiable, I guess is my point.
Well, and I think the last piece when we're thinking about outcomes that I just – the last thing thought I have about that is I think a lot of times we forget about – right now, like we're thinking about as parents, we're thinking about the outcome when our kids are on their own. But what about like what life is like for them right now? Like all of childhood doesn't need to be solely to prepare to be an adult. Like that's like 18 years that, you know, there could be so much joy in those 18 years and so much learning and growth and stuff that matters. Like all we know we have is today right now. So I don't want to sacrifice that. I just don't want to sacrifice that. I think that's worthy of protecting too.
I totally agree. And I think so many, it's when you start talking about the unschooling finger quotes approach, people, I think there's some impulse to try and evaluate it in the school frame. School is a set of tracks that you get on when you're five and you get off when you're 17, right? It's segmented into three sections, elementary school, middle school, and high school. And I've sat through the meetings where they talk about this sort of real-time evaluation and changing direction that we're talking about, that you get to do every day, almost right. down to the minute, by like living consciously through this experience and being a participant in it. I've seen like they pay lip service to this because it would look insane if you didn't. Mm-hmm. But I also felt like it was very superficial. You know, I've spent, speaking of like regrets as a teacher, if I added up all the hours I spent writing IEPs, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that just gets to the, as a matter of procedure yeah. to just get them filed away and not really implement them because they weren't really, they're just like, so-and-so will improve his ability to do standard 679.5 by 30% by June 1st, mm-hmm. you know, and over and over and over again, right? So wow. you go through the motions of doing that, and then you have meetings, and I sat in meetings about accommodations and modifications yep. and making changes. But you're stuck in that environment, you know, right. and you're stuck following a similar set of rules and a similar routine from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like all of the things that people would bring from the evaluation of school into this don't really seem to apply, you know, in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I think just as like taking outcomes from like, okay, what happens to your youngest is one?
He just turned two.
Where's he going to be in 16 years, right? That's an right. insane question to yeah, ask.
Right. Well, and it's like, you know? Well, hopefully he'll be alive. Yeah. By the way, not everyone lives until they're 50 or 100 or whatever, right?
And so right.
like, by sacrificing, by the whole societal agreement that we're just investing 18 years into this process, I think it's kind of nuts. And I think not honoring someone whose days on earth are unknown, you know, mm-hmm. Not honoring that person's will and autonomy. Like, you know, we talked about the mm-hmm. practical aspects of, you know, is it best for your child or isn't it? But I think like on a moral level, on a human level, you know, on a libertarian level, if that's your thing, when you have a human being in front of you saying, I do not want to do this. And you say you have to, I think the burden of proof for that, taking that person out of that one precious moment that they have in life and saying you must do this because reasons, your reasons have to be really, really, really strong. And I think that great, it's such a great point about this forced investment of unknown returns, right? Like it would be one thing too.
All agreed, or most people have agreed that that is a good enough reason.
Well, there are questions you can't ask, right? It's like, you can't ask the question like, is it better to send a kid to school for their long-term well-being or isn't it, right? Like that's not a question anyone is asking. And I think that's like where so many people get lost, because if society all assumes that that potentially false premise is true,
yeah.
then you will invest 18 years in standards and standardized tests. And like, what if it's all wrong? Like you invested 18 years, 20% right. of most people's natural lives in something that was worse for them. Like
yeah.
That's pretty risky.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And entirely unquestioned.
Yeah.
Not entirely, but for the most part.
Largely, yeah.
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 So one more thing that I wanted to connect with you guys on, I mentioned it earlier, and it's something that you brought up on the podcast. We've all had experiences working with young people when we knew a lot less, and when we had a lot less experience with young people than we do now. And I certainly remember feeling like I knew what to do because I was trained, or I was modeling my behavior, my decision-making after people who did the same job and had been in that environment longer, you know, like mentor teachers, my student teaching experience. I know you guys had these experiences as at camp, and you probably had quite a few, you know, as an educator, Taylor. So I've used some pretty harsh language that suggests I had kind of a harsh assessment of myself in that time. Mm. I said, it slipped out of my mouth, and then I was really questioned on this and when I said it. But many, many years ago, I said, school sucks is a kind of penance for what I did when I was a teacher, you know? Or I owe every kid that I taught in the 2004, 2005 school year an apology. Mm. I should write them all an apology letter. You know, things like that. I think we all have experiences that are like that, but I'd like to hear about how you guys have processed that stuff. But,
no, that's, I mean, that's huge. I think how I've processed it, I mean, I'm not sure, but I can think of a couple particular students from my 4 or 5 years of teaching that I actually have thought about, like, gosh, if I could reach out to that child now, first of all, because I'm just really curious how they're doing, but also to kind of say, like, man, I'm sorry that I wasn't your ally. Like, I could have been an ally to you, but instead, I mean, I was always kind to my students, but instead I went along with what all the other educators were thinking needed to happen. And again, these were the kids who would, if had they been in public school, it was like they would have had an IEP. And, you know, we had our own version of that at my private school. And, you know, I went along with kind of holding them accountable to meeting these standards and making sure, you know, that I filled out the forms that needed to be filled out so that they could get medicated and things that I would never in a million years dream of doing now. Mm. And so, yeah, I have thought about like, gosh, I just want to reach out to her and just say, I'm sorry. Like I could have helped you here and I didn't. Yeah. I thought I was, but I wasn't. Cause I just didn't think the way that I think now. So that's been, yeah, that's been a weird one to think about as we kind of have gone through this process and changed our minds about a lot of things. I also think that the one person who I'm still trying to process kind of the way that I was with them, that I wouldn't do the same now, is our son, our oldest son,
sure.
just when he was a baby. There's just so many, you know, I mean, obviously I had two more babies after him mm-hmm. and I mothered them so differently after my experience with him and what I learned. And he's one that I'm still processing it with. I think James and I still go through a process of being like, man, I wish we'd given him a better first year.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to my feelings, because I've worked with so many, like thousands of kids now across multiple different arenas, and like, I can't possibly have handled every situation perfectly. And I need to give myself the space to not be perfect, because if I don't, then I will just wind up beating myself up and I will make myself worse for the kids I'll work with in the future. And
yeah.
I just think like at this point in my yeah. life, I'm such a different person than I was 10, forget about 20 years ago, that like, I can't sit around telling myself a story that I'm still that same person, and I can't beat myself up now for the person I was 10 years ago. Cause like, what am I supposed to do about that? Right. So I think I've moved past it. I do think in the same vein that apologies are appropriate for mm-hmm. certain types of transgressions and certain, you know, certain sorts of behaviors. Actually, one of the things I did, I don't even know if I've ever told you about this, but I have apologized in adulthood to people I was unkind to in high school. Mm-hmm. It's like I reached out to three or four guys and said, hey, I was a real jerk to you. I think you were just a nice person doing your best. And I wish I didn't do that. You know? Mm-hmm. And I got a pretty mixed reaction. I think three of the four were like, what are you talking about? Like, you were never one of the ones that was really mean to me, because these were people who everyone was mean to. And yeah. I was just joining the chorus of people mm-hmm. telling them that they weren't good enough. But for whatever reason, it stuck with me. And one person reached back out and was like, yeah, thanks for saying that. Like, I was always confused why you didn't like me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we just actually had a conversation around it. And it was like really painful. But I'm really glad I did it. And that wasn't even working with kids when I was a grown up. That was working with teenagers when I was a teenager in some level. But I don't know. I want to make space for apologies in my life, because I think you can apologize without feeling ashamed. And like, we apologize to our kids frequently mm-hmm. when we feel like we've done the wrong thing or made the wrong call, or, you know, gotten frustrated with them for something that was inappropriate, or acted away when it was appropriate to be frustrated that we weren't proud of. Right. And I think that's just part of having a real authentic relationship with people. When you respect someone, when you do something that you wish you didn't do.
Yeah.
I apologize for that. And so, yeah, I continue to try to hold myself to that standard while also not carrying shame around with me, because I just want to keep finding better answers, because I know I'm going to have so many more years on this earth working with kids, my own and the ones that I do via camping. And like, I just need to find better answers, because mm-hmm. I want to apologize to fewer people in the future.
That's a good way to think about it. I mean, this was a debate that we were having on our show recently, about bad feelings. And the advice that was given was just don't feel bad. Certainly wasn't my advice, because that's right. not how feelings work. You
right.
know, bad feelings come with the things that we've done. And I asked you guys that because, you know, over the last decade or so, as it's gotten easier to connect with people from the past and to find people from yeah. the past, I've had quite a few students like hit me up on MySpace or Facebook, you know. And when that happens, I mean, sometimes I'll say hi. And any time that I kind of went into like more of a conversation, it just didn't feel right, you know? Mm. I mean, even though these people are adults now, it's just like,
yeah. It's...
But when I walked away from those conversations, there was always that like, I should have said something like, hey, I hope you haven't taken and run with the history I was teaching you guys too much in 2004, because I've learned a lot since then. Wasn't even so always so much about the way I treated people. Like, I was coming, my authoritarianism was about information, mm-hmm. right? As if I had the monopoly on the truth,
okay.
because I didn't know anything. And that's the easiest time to think you know everything.
Right.
Like, I was pretty fresh out of college and I was starting to learn things on my own, as college had been a kind of rudder to turn me into looking for certain types of information for confirmation bias, instead of like panning across the entire right. sea. You know, the rudder of school and college goes this way. And then you just kind of go. Yeah, you just kind of drift, totally. Especially if you don't have very good critical thinking skills. Mm-hmm. You go where the wind takes you. And that was certainly me at that time. And I felt like I inflicted that on the young minds of a lot of kids. And getting these messages on MySpace and Facebook, it made me say, if this person is reaching out to me 6 years after I said goodbye to them at school, I had an impact on their life. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, how many more of them feel that way? And what is that impact? What do they remember about me? And just thinking about where I was at that time, intellectually and professionally and emotionally, it's scary sometimes, you know? But yeah, I really think that bad, it's okay that bad feelings come as long as they're not converted into guilt. And I think the recognition that I've tried to take that experience and move in a more positive direction steadily. But yeah, there still is that question about like, that impact, and is there any remedy, you know?
You know, I don't think there is in some way, you know, and I think that's like part of the messy process of being human.
Yeah.
Like we're going to screw each other up and tell each other wrong things. And especially as a parent, you're going to do that. And I don't know if something's important enough, I think it's worth revisiting. And sometimes it's like, it's just out of your hands. You know, like there are certain relationships I've had in my life where it's like, it hurts me a little bit to think, especially like I used to do not history education, but teaching camp counselors how to work with kids. And I would teach them like tricks on how to trick your kid to hurry up and get out of the cabin or like go to bed when they didn't want to and stuff like that, that I would never teach now. Right. And it's like, I wouldn't go back and revisit all of those because it's like, I don't know. It just feels like it's in the wind now. You know, it's like the old story about the guy who rips open the pillow on top of the house and all the feathers go. It's like chasing down those things and being like, wait, I told you this thing and I don't think it's true. Like that's not the biggest impact I can have probably. That's
right.
That's for me, you know, I just based on my relationships.
Yeah, your impact is likely bigger going forth with what you do now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so.
Especially with so much more information and such a bigger platform.
Right, yeah, right. And I think that it's also like thinking about what the bad feelings, then what do we do with those bad feelings, right? Like, you know, we've all changed our minds about a lot of things and we've taken that and it's motivated us to become, I think, better versions of ourselves. And I mean, there's still a lot more work to be done for myself, I know, but it's kind of taking those bad feelings and seeing, you know, well, how can I continue to be a critical thinker and continue to make changes based on new information that comes to me.
Yeah. And I think you need to experience those bad feelings as a motivation to do that. So I think that yes, that is fine. So guys, this has been phenomenal.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Oh, and
thanks
I
for coming over.
Yeah. Yeah. This is great. I love your home. I love that there's things to swing and hang from in the living room.
Every
almost.
Room,
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You can see more if you want.
Yeah, he got the tour. He got the grand tour before.
Oh, he got the messy upstairs tour too. Huh?
Yeah, I did.
And I cleaned up downstairs, but
with the rings and the climbing wall.
Exactly. Yep, yep.
In bedrooms, that's awesome.
That's how we roll.
And I enjoyed meeting all three of your kids. That was awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of surreal in some ways, you know, to have you meeting our kids from when, you know, hearing your voice on dog walks when we were walking when our youngest was just a babe.
Yeah, that's wild.
And swaddling clothes, you know, so it's pretty cool to have.
Yeah, that is awesome. How old was your youngest when you found School Sucks?
I guess he would have been...
Was it around the same time?
I was still in New Jersey, so he must have been like 6 months old.
Yeah,
so
wow.
Almost exactly 7 years ago.
That makes my day.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's awesome. That's so. For the people in my audience, I would love for them to listen to your show based on what I've heard of it so far.
Much.
I think a lot of people would find it really, really valuable. So let's just talk about it for a couple of minutes before we wrap up.
One Free Family.
So One Free Family is our podcast, and I think you kind of alluded to this a little bit before, but we really intentionally are trying to create something that is feeling welcoming to people wherever they are on the journey of kind of parenting. And if you want to call it peaceful parenting or gentle parenting or self-directed education, we talk a lot about that. There's a lot of, or not a lot, there's a couple great unschooling podcasts out there that I love and I highly recommend to people who want to dive further into self-directed education. But we really wanted to fill a different niche, I think. And cause we know so many people in our own lives and meet so many people who are like, I'm not sure if I buy everything you're saying or who are, you know, kind of feel defensive when they hear what we're doing. And we wanted to be able to kind of like open the doors to those people and say like, hey, let us just tell you what we do. And even if like one little morsel is valuable to you and you just kind of make one small change to have a little bit more connection with your kid, then we're really glad that you found us. So I think that's been a really intentional approach that we've taken.
I love that.
Yeah, we have a Facebook group, a One Free Family, where we invite parents of all different stripes and approaches. And there's been a lot of really healthy, positive, affirming conversation about Yeah, just wrestling with all the different ideas that we bring up on the show. And then also just whatever, that's where we get most of our show prep, is just real life parents dealing with real life issues. And we just did an episode about money and do you buy toys for your kids?
If they're people just come in there
in the store
and
asking and demanding things. And I don't know, it's cool. Cause I think when it comes to parenting in particular, like I've worked in fields where there is a great deal more precision and right answers about things. And when it comes to parenting, having engaged with tons of material about this, I'm not persuaded that there are a lot. I think there are some. I don't think there are a lot of right answers. And so our podcast is about our ongoing process of finding righter answers for our life and just sharing what we're encountering along the way. And like, you know, hopefully owning the decisions that we don't love anymore and just trying to find better ones. And for people that are there and, you know, willing to look inside, like we're just looking to connect with people that are willing to think critically about how they're parenting, because wherever they're at, we have, you know, people in our group that are schooling their kids, doing the really traditional thing all the way to, you know, the most extreme quote unquote radical unschoolers that are out there. And they're all just coming together, you know, linking arms with the really difficult work that is taking responsibility for a young child. Like that's,
and
that's just hard.
I think I was worried a little bit that it would water it down by being so like open to people wherever they are. I was a little worried, like, are we kind of hedging or what? But I haven't seen that to be true at all. Like, I really think it's just been a place that maybe people who want to explore this a little bit, but maybe don't feel welcome in more of like the hardcore, like radical unschooling spaces.
Sure.
They feel like, okay, I can come here and I can be honest about where I'm at and I'm not going to feel worried about sharing that. And maybe I can get some ideas to find a little more peace.
And that comes through. That really comes through in the show.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
Thank you
so much. So that's great that you said that because it's clear.
What we do, not what you should do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Well, Taylor, James, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Brett.
Super fun.
Awesome.
Getting thrown in our direction, but the path out.